roll tape.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Whenever we want to... No, this isn't really relevant at all. I was thinking about it to drive over.
Okay.
We can prove the Earth is a sphere without actually having to go into space, without actually having to do any kind of instrument other than, like, a protractor. What you do is go up to... So imagine you're a flat earther, and you're like, prove to me the Earth is round, but you can't use satellites and all these stuff because that's all a conspiracy, right?
Okay.
Because they say that stuff.
Right.
So what you can do is... No telescopes or anything either.
Right.
So what you can do is say, all right, we're going to go to the North Pole, which is... We're going to just pick any spot on the Earth, but we're going to pick the North Pole to start.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to start walking in some direction until we get to the equator.
Okay.
We're going to turn 90 degrees exactly, and we're going to walk the same exact distance along the equator that we walked from the North Pole to the equator. So let's say we turned left, and we're going to hit that next spot, whatever that distance is, we're going to turn exactly 90 degrees left again and walk the same exact distance. We'll end up back at the North Pole, which is a triangle. If it was a flat Earth, you would have to walk... you have to make a square. But like, because it's a sphere, you make 290-degree turns, and you're back where you started.
Like, I just look at it and go...
But, Creighton, what if the Earth is supposed to be spinning? It's not spinning, because you can't end up... I don't know. They always make stupid arguments, but...
I guess I look at it and I go, why are you even bothering trying to debunk their argument?
Oh, no, I was just thinking about it on the drive over. It was just...
Prove to me the Earth is...
Shower thoughts.
Flat earther.
You can't prove anything to them.
Have you ever met a flat earther?
Not in person.
I haven't either, so I think it's all just bullshit.
Oh, they're all over the internet.
Oh.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's tons of trolls who just do it for the same... Everything's got a troll, but... There are people out there that straight up believe
it, man. Sure there are.
It's just one of those...
I've never met anybody.
Geocentrists who think that the Earth is the center of the universe.
Where everything revolves around us.
And a lot of them tend to be more religious, though. Like, they're like, if you read the Old Testament, it says the Earth was made before the heavens. Earth was made first. Earth was actually made before the sun. And all this kind of stuff as proof that the Earth is the center of the universe.
Yeah, but when did he make light? Didn't he make light on the first day?
There's actually two... There's two conflicting creation accounts in Genesis.
Yeah, right. Yeah, one's more a broad...
What, in the Bible? There's conflicting reports?
One is a broad overview, and then another's a more specific, but...
It's basically two different myths got stuck together.
Right.
But he created light before he created the sun, right? Pretty sure.
Well, no, he... I'm pretty sure that's... It never says that he created the sun. He created light. He created... In one account, he created, you know, he separated night and day, he separated the skies. Like, basically, the writers of the biblical account viewed... Oh, that's the cat. Basically, they viewed, like, they didn't know that sky was... They thought, like, the sky was basically a cloth, and that the stars had, like, the stars were, like, pierced holes in the cloth. And that tent poles held it up. I mean, so...
That's actually many, many primitive religions.
Yeah.
They actually... The religious studies people call it the Axis Mundi. It's a pole that holds the heavens up.
Right.
And a lot of these places, like churches or whatnot, they'll recreate the Axis Mundi by having, like, a pillar or a tree or something. Just a giant... Like, in even, like, aboriginal tribes have a stick that they carry around that bends... And it bends with the wind, and they follow the direction of the stick because they're nomadic. They don't have a set place, so they'll follow the direction of the stick, and that's how they stay in line with the spiritual realm, is that the stick is the Axis Mundi. This is a sacred stick, and wherever it points is where they have to go.
That's why they don't have a space program.
Okay.
But I'm actually right now, I finished Brothers Karamazov.
Already?
Well, I finished
How fast do you read?
I try and get at least 100 pages a day.
Jeez, I wish I had that kind of time.
And then I did 1984. I actually read that in a day. That one was only...
Yeah, that's like a four-hour read.
Yeah. And then I read Thus Spoke Zarathustra. That one, I'm going to have to read his other stuff that isn't so symbolic, because he was trying so hard to make it be a mock of the New Testament for obvious reasons, because he was atheist and he was trying to fight the religious fight sentiment. Power. But I just started The Sacred and the Profane by Mircea Eliade,
mm-hmm.
and it's a religious studies book. It's nonfiction. And he talks about it, the sacred being like, what does religious man, how do they perceive their specific traditions? It's not like a study of religion. Like, it's not a study of Christianity or a study of the myths of various religions. It's like kind of what's their mindset,
right,
in regards to their sacred and stuff. It's pretty interesting.
Sounds interesting. All right, I think I got this. Okay. Close this. YouTube. Once, twice, three times, a non-binary human.
Human action in volumes?
Yeah. That's the way that Amazon sells it. It's through the Liberty Fund. Liberty Fund broke it out.
I have the Mises version.
Oh, the Mises Scholars Institute edition.
Yeah. I read it once, but frankly, that's one, like, if you're going to be a grad student or something, you probably want to refer to that. But if you're going to read, if you want to get the same thing that a Human Action gives you,
right,
but get it in a way that's easy to digest, read Man, Economy, and State.
Mm.
It actually is a little bit better because it addresses some of the parts where because he wrote Human Action for grad students, basically. So it takes it as a given that you understand the more fundamental stuff about, like, their production theory and stuff.
Yeah.
Human Action just says, you're a layman. You have, the only thing you have is an interest in the subject. I'm going to give you everything. And it ties together production theories. He critiques various, like, even the Austrians. Like, he critiques Bombo Varick, who's the guy who, so, like, if Menger is the first Austrian, right? He's the guy who started the Austrian school.
What, kitty?
His big thing that he did was he went out and he looked at what people were actually doing in the market to kind of see what are they doing, and then I can describe it with economics, figure it out. And he also was one of the main marginalists who was about the subjective theory of value as goods are valued based on just how people want to value them. There's no, like, objective mm-hmm. value to anything. And it's all about discrete units. It's not, you don't value all the bread in the world versus all the diamonds in the world.
Yeah.
You value specific uses of specific instances of and bread versus specific
people too.
Yeah. So that's kind of his thing. And then Bombo Varick he's like the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy, he worked as the treasurer for one of the German Austrian, I think he was the treasurer for some German guy. One of the governments of Germany before Hitler. He's the guy who, like, really got the production theory going, like, how does capital valued, the structure through time, interest rates correlating everything together. Right. Mises tied all that together, really, and he was big because he really got popular because he was, like, he just destroyed socialism as an economic discipline. Like, he just destroyed, like, he showed that it literally couldn't work. It's not a matter of, can we have people just really want to make socialism work, and if they're all on the same page, then it'll work. It's like, it's just impossible. Like,
right.
You literally can't have socialism be effective at allocating resources towards the most desired ends of consumers, mm-hmm. basically. And then the next generation would be probably Rothbard, because I'd say Hayek is at the same time as Mises.
Right.
And Rothbard wrote Man, Economy, and State. Right. He kind of tied it all together.
Yeah.
Like, he did everything, and he got the production. So the best part of that book is the, like, four or five chapters on the theory of capital. Like, how does production happen? What do interest rates do? The structure through time. You know, if you had the quote equilibrium, like in high school, we talked about an equilibrium, mm-hmm. this is the price. Well, imagine we were in the equilibrium. What would production look like? And, like, just describing how prices would deal with that. And he adds a bunch of stuff about, like, the effect of government on the market, taxes, and all this kind of stuff. It's really good, but it's an easy read if you're interested.
It better be an easy read because...
It's a long read. Don't get me wrong. It's like...
I'm functionally illiterate.
Because Mises Institute sells it with power and market attached.
Right.
Which is like, take all the stuff Man Economy and State said about the free market, and then what happens when government is involved with it. Because in Man Economy and State, there's only one chapter that deals with that. Power and Market's literally an entire book about it. But Power and Market, they sell it, Man Economy and State and Power and Market together. It's like 1,500 pages.
Really?
But if you buy just Man Economy and State, it's like 800, 900 pages. It's still a long read, and it's obviously not exhilarating because it's an economics textbook, basically.
It's all economic, yeah. Oh shit!
But
why are you all dressed up, Creighton? You got a date?
No, I just put on a
he's gonna be on
long
camera,
sleeve
man.
Shirt that it's kind of cold out, yo. I have to drive over here. You get to just sit around in your
swooshy shorts,
yeah, in your normal clothes all day.
I don't stay here. Like,
I know.
I go to work.
I know.
I was at work at 7 a.m. today.
Ooh.
I did take a nap though because I was not gonna be able to do this without a nap. Nobody likes cranky me.
Especially Mittens.
Yeah, Mittens doesn't want any of that cranky shit. She won't have it. I don't know if Galt's coming or not.
Last text I saw, he said he was, he'd sold all of his AT&T stock, so I don't know.
Alright.
Could have been him in the wreck. You know?
Oh, Mittens.
You fuck with me?
I'm interested to see what happens then. Tomorrow and in the next week with the stock market, I don't know if it's going to be going. I don't think this is the trigger for like a recession. Just because I haven't seen, I don't know. I'm not an expert on the stock market, but there's eventually going to be some sort of market correction that's
absolutely
really bad because all of that printing that the Fed has done
QE,
is just.
Yeah.
Crazy misallocates resources. That's the whole,
right?
It's the whole problem with it. But whether or not it's going to happen now, or I mean, that's the problem with knowing how economics work. You can say this is what should happen, and this is what will happen, but you can't say when it's going to happen.
And nobody knows timeline or what else is going to factor in.
Right.
Is that a video?
Yep.
God damn it, I just sat there and looked like an idiot.
Oh well.
Should have danced. Should have stood up and did a dance?
Should have.
Okay.
What are you doing, buddy?
Alright, let's not wait for him. No sense in that. Okay. Okay, I think I have everything. I think I'm ready. All right, here we go. Let's see. Pop out the chat.
I'm tired. Can we get this over with?
Well, it should go pretty quick because we're doing like half a dozen stories.
Yeah, let's just do that.
Yeah, instead of one long subject. So it should be pretty brisk. We won't get bored. All right, here we go.
Speak for yourself.
Shut up. Tad. Check, check. Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I am your host, Chris Spangle. We bring you all of the irreverence modern politics deserves while putting people before political parties. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective with the goal of leaving you better informed. Please be sure and rate and review us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and subscribe on Patreon at WeAreLibertarians.com. In exchange for supporting our program, we give you all kinds of bonus content and free stuff. This show is crowdsourced, so you can send us news with the hashtag WALNews or in our Facebook group or Discord channel. We're always taking your questions and comments via email at editor@WeAreLibertarians.com. Please be warned that this show is raw, unedited, and authentic, so the language is sometimes strong and offensive. We're going to cover a lot today. We're going to cover the developments in the Uranium One scandal. Clinton cash is coming true. We're going to cover the changes in some of the investigation. Tad Western is here to really bring us up to date on a lot of that. We're going to talk gerrymandering. We're going to talk all kinds of different things. With me this episode is Tad Western. Tad, how are you?
I'm doing well, Mr. Spangle. How are you?
Nice of you to be here. Thanks for being here.
Oh, no problem. Anytime. Long time no see.
How I know. Been? I've been great. Last
You're
time
looking
I,
great.
Last
nice
time
and
I,
slim.
Yeah, last time I saw you, you were wrangling Phillies over at the Stacked Pickle.
I don't remember or know what Phillies are, but congratulations, Philly, on winning the Super Bowl.
And Creighton Harrington. Creighton, how are you?
Pretty good.
Chris Gault was supposed to be here. We don't know if he's alive or dead, but we decided to start anyways, so if he shows up, he's here.
I heard he had information leaned to the rest of Hillary Clinton.
So, yes, lots of good stuff going on today. You've got to be... let's start with the SpaceX rocket.
Yeah.
You had to have an Elon Musk boner.
Oh, man.
Yesterday, Creighton.
He's quickly becoming my favorite billionaire. Like... The guy is, like I said in a Facebook post, he's the kid who grew up, became rich, but never actually grew up.
Right.
Like, all of the stuff he's doing is not only is it useful, but it's just awesome.
Yeah.
Like, the Tesla is, for all intents and purposes, an adult RC car.
It's true.
It is a Barbie car, yeah.
He made a flamethrower just because.
Why not?
Like, somebody's like, you should make a flamethrower. You know, that's a good idea. I'll make a flamethrower. And he made a flamethrower.
He's like, I need $20 million real quick. So he just, he's like, I'm going to make, make some flamethrowers. And they sold out in eight hours.
Right. And you watch the videos of him with it. He's like holding it and he's like shooting flames. Then he comes running at the cameraman with it.
The best part is it looks like a squirt gun or something.
Yeah.
And he just kept like retweeting anybody. This is going to cause $45 million in insurance damages. And he'd like retweet it and be like, my bad. his Twitter and Instagram is hilarious.
And then, you know, he's like, you know what? I should put my car into space. Like, somebody said, you can't have a rocket car. Like, oh, yeah, watch me.
Right.
You know? It's like just, and not even that, the way they sent it up is awesome. Like, they got a dummy in there, so it just looks like there's an actual guy driving the car. But yeah. Then they played Space Oddity by David Bowie when they showed it. And I don't know if you've watched the live feed of it when it shot off and it showed.
When it separated.
It is awesome.
It's pretty badass.
It is awesome.
The best part is the dash of the Tesla Roadster looks like Pepe.
Really?
Yeah, look at it. It's got two vents and then the, it looks like the frog.
So apparently David Bowie.
Pretty awesome.
David Bowie played Tesla at one point.
In
a movie.
The Prestige.
Yeah. And
played
so
Nikola Tesla.
Everyone's wondering if that's why he played David Bowie, but.
Well, Space Oddity's been a favorite of space faringness for a long time, so.
The coolest thing, I didn't watch the whole feed, but someone showed me the rockets, the boosters landing back on the pad, and it was the most. It was like it was like our generation's moon landing. It was one of the most amazing technological feats I've ever seen in my life, and it made you go, anything is possible. Somebody else, I can't figure how to do that out, but somebody smarter than me can.
Well, what I love about that in SpaceX in general is, so back before SpaceX really got going, when NASA was in its doldrums as the space shuttle started to wind down, and they lost a lot of funding from Congress, and people just didn't really care about the space program a lot. A lot of people were, they were sad that the space generation was over, I guess. Like,
right, the space races.
Like, we hadn't been to the moon since the 70s. The space shuttle was kind of the last thing that people could look to and say, that's identifiably, like, heroic pioneers and stuff.
Yeah,
the International Space Station, that doesn't really as exciting, but... A lot of people were thinking, you know, we need NASA. We really need NASA to do this because implicit in their remarks was there's no private company that could do this. And then people come in and they're like, oh, yeah, you're going to monetize space and you're going to make it be all for profit and just all this kind of stuff. And a big problem people had was like, how could you make it profitable? Like, you would never have it because, you know, all of this, wouldn't be profitable. And in comes Elon Musk, and he's like, you know what? Why don't we reuse all of the stuff instead of just dropping it off and never using it again, waste all this money? Why don't we reuse it? So he spent a lot of the early times not trying to figure out how they could build a rocket powerful enough to go to Mars in like a year or two. They said, how can we build a rocket that we can use again?
Yeah, because he figured, well, shit, we'll save all the money and we'll be able to reuse them and we'll get government contracts.
Right, and that's just a testament to the ingenuity that is unlocked when you give people the freedom to actually try stuff. And it's a testament to the ingenuity of just people trying to seek a profit in the free market. I mean, granted, you know,
they get a lot of money from the government still because they do contracts.
Doesn't he get a lot of subsidies?
Yeah, they do, and NASA works with them a lot. So it's not like they're like an independent agency that exists completely on the free market. But nevertheless,
but if somebody at NASA was like, "Hey, let's reuse these rockets," they'd be like, "Why the fuck?"
Right?
Like,
yeah,
it's taxpayer dollar.
Yeah, they would say, "There's no reason for us to do all of that effort. Why don't we build another Mars rover?" Which, I mean, what NASA did is always was still good. I'm not saying anything bad about NASA.
I am. They faked it all.
But I think it's just a testament to you put an incentive in place where you don't have an unlimited budget. You have a finite resource here
of humans who pay taxes.
You have to figure out how to do what you want to do with that constrained budget. And people think of amazing things. And they thought of how to reuse rockets. They literally were like, why don't we just have them land back where they took off?
Right.
That's impossible. Well, apparently not, because they can do it. And
landing it on a barge.
Yeah, they landed on a barge. I guess it hit a little hard.
Yeah.
So
I think one of them fucked up.
One of them was 30 feet off.
But it's like, it was a test run, for one. Yeah.
Right.
So I would say that is a mostly successful test.
Are they so? Is the car going to Mars heading or the sun so, or what was the purpose of the whole thing?
That was just a test run to show that they had a rocket that could carry a payload that heavy.
Just to put a car into space,
and he just put a car in there because that's a payload heavy enough. They said, "Oh, that'd be fun."
Right?
He's like, "Fuck you, I'm rich."
And it's
free advertising.
It's supposed to go to Mars, but I saw a tweet that
it's
going to
overshoot.
It's going
to hit Jupiter.
And it's going to go into
the asteroid belt. Yeah.
So.
Oh, well.
May not end up at Mars.
Hope that car's got good insurance.
But, like, just think about it. And like,
you've been working on that one all week, Tad?
You know? Did it? Actually, Jeff Bibber wrote that
like
one for 3, me.
In 3,000 years, some alien civilization is going to come upon this car and be like, what the hell is
David
this?
David Bowie.
What if the aliens actually do find it and they think that's a real person? They're like, why?
Right?
What is going on? They dissect this robot or suit or whatever the hell it is.
Maybe they find it first, and then when we actually make contact with them, they know what to expect, you know?
Now, I watched that, and I bet Creighton's going to be really excited. Then today, I see the news breaking on Fox, and I go, Tad must be really excited.
I'm harder than the Boring Company right now.
Because the Clinton Cash book is coming true, the Peter Schweitzer book, which if you haven't read, you must read Clinton Cash, because it's all about to fall apart.
Well, as Tad Western predicted about, 8 months ago when
yep.
I was on here?
You know, all the conspiracy theories pushed by Tad Western...
Well, my theories aren't really theories. I actually study everything, and I look at the documents, and then I put two and two together, and then I get validated later on when text messages come out in Congress and congressional hearings and everything else.
So let's start with this is a Fox News article. So, you know, it's Fox News.
It's fake. It's Russian propaganda,
right,
man.
Exactly.
I'm a Russian agent, too, by the way. I just need to disclose that.
But this was broken by The Hill, which is the most centrist of all the Washington Press publications. Uranium One informant says Moscow paid millions in bid to influence Clinton. An informant claims Russian nuclear officials told him Moscow hired an American lobbying firm, APCO Worldwide, in hopes of influencing Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, through contributions to the Clinton Foundation, Griff Jenkins reports. Tad?
What? That's a conspiracy, man. Nobody would ever do that. She's not allowed to accept any foreign money as Secretary of State from her foundation?
An FBI informant involved in the controversial Uranium One deal has told congressional committees that Moscow paid millions to a U.S. lobbying firm in a bid to influence her by helping former President Clinton his charities during the Obama administration. The Hill first reported late Wednesday that informant Douglas Campbell gave a 10-page statement to the Senate Judiciary Committee, House Intelligence Committee, and House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and was interviewed for several hours behind closed doors by committee staff. I saw reports today that he has tapes.
Yeah, he's got recordings.
So since this is a conspiracy, the contract, he said, called for 4 payments of $750,000 over 12 months. APCO was expected to give assistance free of charge to the Clinton Global Initiative as part of their effort to create a favorable environment to ensure the Obama administration made affirmative decisions on everything from Uranium One to U.S.-Russia civilian nuclear agreements. APCO called the assertion false and unfounded. For their part, they said they worked on behalf of 10X in 2010 and 11 and it undertook...
Go ahead.
Which would have been involved with Iran's nuclear power plants coming online. Around 20.
What is 10X?
13 as well. 10X?
10X?
10X was the Russian company that owns that's like their power company.
Gotcha.
Their state-run power company that also sold Iran. They went in with Iran for their nuclear. Remember when they said, "Oh, we're gonna sanctions. We're building power plant."
Right.
I talked about that.
And the United States is like, "Oh yeah, sure you are."
Yeah, I talked about that on the last one.
And the UN had to go in and inspect it all the time. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, it looks good.
Okay, so they say it's two separate projects. Never happened. So since we're dealing with a conspiracy theory, I figured I'd go over to Zero Hedge, which I think is a great site. You get a lot of news that you wouldn't see anywhere else, a lot of market news. And this is their coverage of it. They have a bunch of bullet points here. Undercover FBI informant William Campbell has given written testimony to Congress after an ironclad gag order was lifted in October. Campbell was a highly valued CIA and FBI assistant, deeply embedded in the Russian nuclear industry, while Mueller was the director of the FBI. Campbell was required by the Russians, under threat, to launder large sums of money, which allowed the FBI to uncover a massive Russian nuclear money laundering apparatus.
What?
He collected over 5,000 documents and briefs over a six-year period, some of which detail efforts by Moscow to route money to the Clinton Foundation. So this is much deeper than just the Clinton Foundation. Campbell claims to have video evidence of bribe money related to Uranium One and the money being stuffed into suitcases. The Obama FBI knew about the bribery scheme, yet the administration still approved the Uranium One deal. So even though it was all a scheme, I mean, anything dealing with Russia, even if you're Obama, let's say Obama was the most upstanding, scandal-free president of them all, you're dealing with Russians. Of course there's going to be schemes going on there.
What? Russians are great people.
Right. To thank him for his service, Campbell was paid $51,000 by the FBI in 2016 at a dinner in Chrysler City. When it emerged that Campbell had evidence against the Clinton Foundation, a Yahoo News article by Michael Isikoff of FISA warrant application fame slammed Campbell as a disaster potential witness. So he was made to sign in, quote-unquote, illegal NDA by former Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and he's finally given his testimony. This is what he said. For several years, my relationship with the CIA consisted of being debriefed after foreign travel. This is in the testimony. Gradually, the relationship devolved into the CIA tasking me to travel to specific countries to obtain specific information. In the 90s, I developed a working relationship with Kazakhstan and Russia and their nuclear energy industries. When I told the CIA of this development, I was turned over to the FBI counterintelligence agencies. So, first, Campbell discovered that Moscow had comprised an American uranium trucking firm, TLI, in violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which bribed Russian nuclear officials in exchange for a contract to transport Russian-mined U.S. uranium, mm-hmm. including yellow cake. Second,
to Canada, correct?
It doesn't say here.
I believe that's the...
Second, Campbell says that the Russian nuclear officials told him of a scheme to route millions of dollars to the Clinton Global Initiative through lobbying firm ARPCO, which was expected to funnel a portion of its annual $3 million lobbying fee to the charity. This contract called for four payments of $750,000 over 12 months. Mm-hmm. APCO was expected to give assistance free of charge to the CGI as part of their effort to create a favorable environment to ensure the Obama administration made affirmative decisions on everything from Uranium One to the U.S.-Russian Civilian Nuclear Cooperative Agreement. Now, Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. The Uranium One deal had to be approved by something like five or seven different parts of the administration, including Timothy Geithner at Treasury, mm-hmm. the President's Office itself, the State Department, the Defense Department, all of them signed off on it. But so... You can't say, oh, well, they just paid off Clinton, but they did donate to a former president and the current Secretary of State, two of the most powerful people in the entire party and incredibly powerful throughout the rest of the government. So you can say, yes, they didn't make the final decision, the ultimate decision, but you're talking about giving money to two incredibly influential people.
Yeah, but did they disclose that they were being paid?
No, and that's the other part of it.
That's the issue.
Right. So essentially you have the weaponization of, it's illegal for an American politician to take foreign money. Absolutely. And you can't donate to, if you're the Russians or if you're Uranium One or any other country, as a corporation, as an individual, you can't give money to any political person. But what they did is they basically have weaponized international corruption.
Well, it's what's been alleged forever is that the Clintons were running, that Hillary was running a pay for play scheme, right, as secretary or as a, yeah, whatever, Secretary of State.
So Campbell told congressional investigators that the Uranium One deal, along with billions in other uranium contracts inside the U.S. during the Obama administration, was part of a Russian uranium dominant strategy, and including 10X and its American arm, Tenem, both subsidiaries of state-owned Russia energy company, Rosatom. And they now have 100% of the world's uranium, or what was it?
I can't remember. It's something outrageous.
I think they bought 100% of this company, but yeah, they have
Well, that was also a deal brokered with Frank Giustra, too.
Yeah.
A billionaire from Canada who's Hillary's largest donor, the Clinton Foundation's largest dealer.
Yeah, Frank Giustra, an energy official from Canada, and one of their best friends, went to this Kazaki trip with Bill Clinton when he went to speak in Kazakhstan and praised a foreign dictator. Campbell writes in this, the emails and documents I intercepted during 2010 made clear that Rosatom's purchase of Uranium One for both its Kazakh and American assets was part of Russia's geopolitical strategy to gain leverage in global energy markets, he testified. I obtained documentary proof that 10X was helping Rosatom win CFIUS approval, including an email, an October 26, 2010 email asking me specifically to help overcome opposition to the Uranium One deal. So energy is incredibly important to Russia. It's how they, I mean, it's how the economy has turned around for Putin. And Putin controls a lot of the oil and nuclear, the oil and natural gas flowing into into Western Europe. And that's why they're hesitant to really go after him too hard. It's why they're in Syria. They're wanting to start to creep into helping control oil reserves too and have greater energy. So Russia's geopolitical aim is that is if they can control
all the energy that Europe uses, then they've got power over them.
Then they've got power over them. So that it's even if none of this is corrupt, it's incredibly stupid from a geopolitical point of view.
It's selling it out for how much was it? It was four payments of $700,000+.
Right, for $3 million to your foundation, like.
That's what's been
from a policy point of view.
That's what's came.
Take the corruption away from take the quote unquote conspiracy of corruption out of this. Just from a political point of view, it was not in the United States' interest to eventually let the Russians control most of the world's uranium.
No, not at all.
So, Wall, then he got involved in some bribery.
Well, who doesn't?
Who doesn't? So this
there's
actually
nothing in this that links specifically Hillary Clinton to any of this, just her foundation, right?
Just the foundation. But, I mean, when you're talking about the foundation employees,
right,
Bill, Hillary, Chelsea, and like 10 other people.
Technically step back from that when they're in office, don't they have to renounce their position in those?
Yeah, they did. They said they were going to day one and they weren't going to take any foreign money.
Right.
No, but I mean, like, don't they technically not hold a position in the foundation when they're serving as heads of state of any kind?
Correct.
Not technically, yeah.
Right, not technically. So, yeah, of course, they could probably get, like, advice emails and stuff, or maybe they still do and they just say they don't, but like as far as on paper, they're not actually affiliated with the organization while they're Secretary of State or something. Now Bill can be because he wasn't serving in any
position. Bill said he was stepping down as well.
Okay.
Yeah, so when Obama announced that she was going to be Secretary of State, many Democrats raised this as a concern. Yep. And Obama at one point brought her to the Oval Office and said, you know, here's the rules. If you want to be Secretary of State, the Clinton Global thing and Bill's activities need to be widely limited. You need to have a firewall between you and that. Like, there can't be foreign donations. He had her sign an agreement along those lines, and she basically did the opposite of everything that was outlined in those agreements. She lied to Obama, and so I think there's not going to be a lot of Obama going, no, you know, like he's done his due diligence with Hillary by saying you should elect her president, and now he's not going to let his legacy get tarnished by her.
Well, but he's already fucked because that's came out that he knew about her private email server and
right.
He was exchanging messages with her on it.
He was sending,
that's came out this week.
He was sending emails back and forth on the private email server and said publicly, I had no idea that she was doing this. Mm-hmm. Now, in Obama's defense, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. How often do you look at the metadata of any email that you send and receive? Especially if you're the president of the United States and you're busy.
Well, there's one theory that, I mean, he can declassify anything he wants, but it's against the law regardless as a government employee. Everything has to be has to be on record to go back if anything needs to be searched.
Right.
So that's where the criminality comes into it.
Well, is that congressional legislation that says that, or is that just executive policy?
No, that's legislation.
Okay.
Yeah, everything has to be
right.
Because if they a Freedom of Information Act is what it's under.
The Obama administration
that's why the original emails were such a big
right,
deal.
Right. Right. Because yeah.
Because they technically didn't have them. I mean, I'm sure the NSA can get them somewhere, but I mean, it's
right. But it's just against policy to not have that on storage. Yeah, I understand.
Right. The other part of it is that any travel that Bill Clinton did had to be approved by the ethics office at mm-hmm. the State Department. And Huma Abedin was overseeing that. So you had Hillary Clinton's top aide basically approving or disproving any travel that Bill Clinton did.
Have you ever seen Clinton Cash or read the book?
No.
It's pretty good, especially now if you go back. I haven't watched it recently, or I think I watched the documentary.
Yeah, but there's even a graphic novel.
There's literally, he would land somewhere, or she would land somewhere, and Bill would already be there, and then, you know, 2 weeks later, there'd be a donation from
right
a very powerful player of whatever region that was to the foundation or
right.
the Clinton Global Initiative.
So,
and it's all on record. I mean, it's
so you're going to hear Mueller's name dragged through the mud a lot on a lot of this stuff, and you might have. And so here's the background on that stuff. While undercover, the Russians forced Campbell to deliver bribes from Maryland Transportation Company, TLI, in $50,000 increments to Russian nuclear official Vladim Mikurin of 10X. Campbell did so under the direction of the FBI in order to maintain his cover, fronting hundreds of thousands of dollars he said he was never reimbursed for. As a result of Campbell's work, well, that could be an important line, says he was never reimbursed for. As a result of Campbell's work, TLI co-president Mark Lambert was charged in an 11-count indictment in connection with the scheme, while Vadim Mirkarin, who resides in Maryland, was prosecuted in 2015 and is halfway through a 4-year sentence. Beginning at least as early as 2009, continuing until October 2014, Lambert conspired with others. Oh no, I can hear my own voice. I'm hearing...
That's never good.
Yeah. I have you guys so loud that
it's picking.
Yeah,
is your mic? Your voice is coming through our mics. Is that what it is?
Something just went really weird with that.
I heard. The hell was that?
That's my breath, you idiots.
Oh.
All right, here we go. There we go.
Freaking me out, man.
I know, I'm like on drugs. Beginning in at least as early as 2009 and continuing till October 2014, Lambert conspired with others at Transportation Corporation A to make corrupt, fraudulent bribery and kickback payments to offshore bank accounts. Of note, Rod Rosenstein failed to interview Campbell before prosecuting Vadim Mikurin when Rosenstein was Maryland's chief prosecutor. Instead relying on the evidence Campbell had gathered. This backfired after prosecutors insisted on sitting down with Campbell to glean more information, forcing prosecutors to recast their entire case against Mikurin. An extremely important aspect of Campbell's timeline is one that the Obama FBI, headed by Robert Mueller, knew of the bribery scheme, with the transportation company before approving the Uranium One deal, which would have utilized TLI for transportation transporting the mined uranium.
So the guy who got arrested for bribery was, they knew that he was bribing, the FBI knew and aided his bribing.
Right.
So he got arrested for basically doing something that the FBI knew about and yes. let happen.
Correct.
Okay.
And Robert Mueller knew about it, and despite this corrupt aspect of the Uranium One deal, Robert Mueller approved the deal, as did Hillary Clinton. So
now, did the guy who was doing the bribing know?
The Russian?
Like, was he? Did he know the FBI was knew? Like, did the FBI basically tell him go ahead and do this, or did he do it and the FBI knew about it and didn't do anything to stop it?
No, the FBI said go ahead and do this.
Oh.
Yeah, they said
they never reimbursed them.
That happens sometimes when you're in the middle and they want and you're breaking.
No, I'm talking
the
about
law.
The Maryland company.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. About? Yeah, okay. They knew that he was involved. He was fronting money. He was involved. He was keeping the scheme going because they didn't want it to blow the cover that he had with some of these other aspects.
And
so,
then they arrested him for it. Anyway.
Exactly right. Well, no. Campbell was not arrested.
Right, that's what I'm asking. The Maryland guy is the one. The company, the Maryland company.
The trucking
guy,
company.
They're the one. That guy is the one who's in prison.
Correct.
Right. Did right. he know, did like the FBI tell him to do this, or did they let him do it?
No.
He just didn't know that they were watching him.
He didn't know they were watching him. Campbell was the only one aware okay. that the FBI was involved in any of this and that he was fronting.
And that's why he's right. testifying to Congress right now.
Exactly.
But he isn't actually having any, he didn't have any criminal charges brought up against him. He's just out a bunch of money that he had to front.
No, exactly. Okay. In fact, quote unquote, my FBI handlers praise my work. They told me on various occasions that details from the undercover probe have been briefed directly to FBI top officials. On two occasions, my handlers were particularly excited, claiming that my undercover work had been briefed to Obama as part of his daily presidential briefing. So here's a guy who...
This is like a Tom Clancy novel.
Yeah, well, dude, it just shows
so,
you...
This
it shows,
so
like,
deep.
Here's one guy who is involved in all... Like, what I think is really going on is Trump won when he shouldn't have won.
Oh, they never expected
it. Right, and so...
Especially reading their papers and...
Into the mic.
Especially reading their papers and text messages that are coming out.
Yeah, and what you had happen, like Michael Flynn said, my situation is only a problem if Trump wins, and that's not going to happen. And I think there's a lot of stuff going on the Clinton side where it's like, it's only a problem if we lose, and that's not going to happen. And so I think what you're seeing now through the House leaks... Because any piece of intelligence that's hitting the House is
right.
being leaked directly to the press.
So did the House intentionally let this out, or is there some guy in the House who's leaking this to the press and they don't know who it is?
I think I don't know how this got out, but I think it was leaked. I think I saw that. I don't know that for sure, but it's part of a greater narrative, right? That
right.
Trump is being unfairly prosecuted while Hillary Clinton is skating. And Hillary Clinton is the one that needs to be investigated.
Right, and it sounds like all of the evidence seems to point to Hillary being the one that actually was colluding with the Russians.
With the Russians. Right, exactly right.
And the only thing that the Russians did as far as help Trump, let's not forget.
Facebook ads?
Is Facebook ads, Twitter, fake Twitter accounts, fake news articles, and then they hacked that private email server.
The DNC, which those...
Allegedly.
Those continual leaks of...
Which didn't have actually any sensitive information. It just had stuff that made the Democrats look bad.
Right.
It just had humiliating stuff on it. It didn't have any, like, undercover people or anything like that.
It exposed what we all already knew, is that Bernie Sanders got screwed.
Yeah, but you hear the media talk about it, and you think that they, like, rigged election booths, like voting machines
and
stuff.
All they do
and
is
that's
just...
That's not what happened. So when they say Russian involvement in the election... They just mean, like,
trying
to sway public opinion. Yeah, they hacked. The hacking is probably the biggest thing. But again, that wasn't, like, all that did was release information to the public that could affect their opinion.
Yeah, the news media is super vague when it comes to anything that actually happened. They don't actually report. They'll say, oh, Russians hacked the DNC. And then you go and you read the DNC emails and you're like, well, wait a minute. This is complete collusion against Bernie to fuck him out of the primary.
Right.
And it's like, why aren't they reporting this? Oh, I wonder why. Because there's just so much bias and everything
and,
else. They won't put the facts out there. They just
and
they
so far, because we know the media would jump on this, so far there has been no evidence that Trump has colluded with Russia, correct?
No. The only evidence they're pointing to is Carter Page, but I'm sure we'll get into that here in a little bit. But
Carter Page was somebody who was he was praising the Russian regime. He was making money off of...
He was an investment banker.
He was an investment banker at Merrill Lynch, and he was somebody who knew Russian politics and economics and was investing in Russian companies. And so he was continually sought after by a lot of different people to get involved in investing. He's a doctor. So he had a lot of credentials that people liked, and then when he was very excited to get on board with the Trump campaign, because anybody who was pro-Russia was anti-Clinton, because they felt that Clinton was going to be extremely harsh against the new regime and provoke a war. And so he got involved in the Trump campaign enthusiastically, and then they started to see, like, oh, okay, you're being investigated. All right, let's push you aside.
Well, they used him. Carter Page, actually, in 2013, was an FBI informant.
Right.
And he actually got, he was, which was leaked through the Obama administration to, like, BuzzFeed or something. They demasked him for whatever reason. But if this all just came out this week, too, so
right.
I haven't been able to put it all together. But there is a theory that he was kind of pushed towards the Trump campaign by... one of Hillary's...
Sidney Blumenthal. Sidney Blumenthal is a name that you're going to hear a lot from here on out, because he's Hillary's fixer.
Yeah.
I'll look up his Wikipedia and give it some of his titles, but he's a bad dude.
It turns out that Page was still being surveilled by the FBI while he was in the Trump campaign, and then that...
And that's part of that memo that came out last week, the Nunes memo, was that he was being surveilled on a FISA warrant that was basically the evidence to support the need for that FISA warrant was a dossier that was paid for by Clinton.
They said his ties justified him being monitored, but he was an FBI informant who got actual... Russians from New York who were actually foreign agents, spies, arrested prior to all this. So they just kind of brought his past up. They knew his past because he had worked with the FBI. So they surveyed him anyway, and they did that for 90 days, I believe, right? Three times what it was. They had to renew it, but there wasn't... They kept the FISA court. If you read the FISA court memo that came out like a year ago, it was like 100 pages, they kept saying this isn't enough to... We're not going to grant this. We're not going to grant it. They ended up being forced to grant it. So that, they gave him the downhill.
So grant it based on the fact that he was an FBI informant working against the Russians.
That. They painted his past work with Russians as an FBI agent make it look bad.
He was an FBI informant against the Russians, but they didn't tell the FISA court that. They just said, look, he's been with the Russians.
Yeah, they used... who his prior contacts were in business contacts who ended up getting busted as actual Russian agents to paint it to like he's a bad guy.
So there's two. So I guess there's two different perspectives on how this FISA warrant surveillance
wasn't even enough. Then they threw the memo on top of that to get the actual
dossier?
Trump. Yeah. They used that dossier
that's another corruption scandal argument is that the dossier was funded
by
Clinton.
Yeah.
Right.
So Clinton,
it was literally op-ed research written by Christopher Steele.
It's all congested, so
oppo research by a political candidate against a person was used as evidence against a person associated with the opposing candidate. So
yes.
Clinton using opposition research against Trump on one of his people associated with his campaign
to get
use that information to get a FISA warrant
to get down
to surveil that guy,
right?
Which means that one political candidate was using the intelligence apparatus of the United States to spy on someone associated
campaign.
With the other political
it
candidate.
It wasn't just him though. They got
now
the down
got
once they got the
yeah.
once they got the FISA. Anyone he was in contact with,
right? So
they can spy on. So
basically,
that's when Trump Tower got when Trump came out and said, "I'm being
wiretapped."
He knew he was wiretapped.
He's not sophisticated enough to understand that it's not a
wiretapping
like the 80s.
Said that, but
right.
no one, he was being surveilled before that as well. Anytime he was with Page, he was under surveillance.
So basically, it seems like the evidence seems to be pointing to there was a concerted effort by Clinton. At least her group, to use the United States intelligence arm for a political purpose to investigate the opposition to her campaign.
Yes.
Okay.
Let's listen to this this piece from Martha McCallum.
It's a Tom Clancy novel.
Yeah,
it's
crazy.
Or City Hall. You ever seen City Hall with John Cusack and Robert De Niro or Al Pacino?
No.
Similar to that.
Here we go.
Chuck Grassley, along with another senior Senate Republican, Lindsey Graham, sent a criminal referral to the Justice Department asking for an investigation of the former British spy Christopher Steele, who compiled the dossier, on the basis that they said there was evidence that he had lied to the FBI about his contacts with the media and the distribution of the dossier. Now, if you can come back to me just a second, you can see we have now received an unclassified version of that criminal referral, and you can see it's very heavily redacted. But buried within the document is a new allegation by the senators that Clinton associates also fed information to Steele. And it reads in part, "It is troubling enough that the Clinton campaign funded Mr. Steele's work, but that these Clinton associates were contemporaneously feeding Mr. Steele allegations raises additional concerns about his credibility." The names of the individuals are redacted in that document, and Senators Graham and Grassley are asking the Justice Department and FBI to now do an emergency declassification because they think much of the document should now be public because some of the information is consistent with what was in that House Intelligence Committee memo that was released on Friday. I think it's worth noting that it may be a case of overclassification by the FBI and Justice Department because there are portions where they redact the title of media reports, including a Washington Post report about the dossier, Sandra.
Any particulars on the information that you're learning that the Clinton associates fed to Steele, Catherine?
It's so heavily redacted, I wouldn't want to guess, but it's very clear. They make the allegation that Clinton associates were also feeding information to Steele at the same time he compiled this dossier, though they reached no conclusions over whether Steele, in fact, used that information or whether it was used by the FBI to verify elements of the dossier.
All right, so you have...
You remember last month, the Republican chairman...
Sorry about that, guys. So then Trey Gowdy comes on. Trey Gowdy was the only person in the House allowed to go in and read the classified information. They chose Trey Gowdy, the House Freedom Caucus. He's on the Oversight Committee to go in and read it because he's a lawyer and has a very, you know, he's very good at questioning.
They don't call him Trey Rowdy Gowdy for no reason.
Right. So he says on the interview after this with Martha McCallum, "The dossier has nothing to do with the fact that someone tried to hack the DNC, the Steele dossier. The dossier has nothing to do with meeting George Papadopoulos that he had in Great Britain. The dossier has nothing to do with Donald Trump Jr. in Trump Tower. The dossier has nothing to do with allegations of obstruction of justice." So he is basically saying, you know, Mueller would have been appointed because the dossier wasn't the sole reason that all of this was part of the investigation. So you can't throw, just because this dossier is now being called into question, you can't throw out the entire Mueller investigation because going back in time, there were legitimate questions that apparently the intelligence community had about Trump's ties to Russia because it looked funny. So, but now that we're fast forwarding to the future, to the present place, there hasn't been anything there. Every time the Russians tried to access that campaign, they were shut down. But Gowdy basically said that that person that was feeding information to Steele was Sidney Blumenthal. He hints at that. Sidney Blumenthal is a former aide to President Clinton, according to Wikipedia, longtime confidant of Hillary Clinton, formerly employed by the Clinton Foundation, and a journalist, especially on American politics and foreign policy. He's written for The Post, Vanity Fair, New Yorker, Salon.com, The Guardian. He served as a senior advisor from 1997 to 2001 for Clinton. He advised on communications. He was known for his loyalty to the Clinton and his attacks on their adversaries, which is one reason Rahm Emanuel, the first chief of staff for Obama, barred Blumenthal from holding a position in the State Department during Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State. He's long since been known as the fixer for Hillary Clinton. He was the hatchet man. So He was a full-time employee of the Clinton Foundation from 2009 to 2013. He served as a consultant for the foundation from 2013 to 2015, earning about $10,000 per month. Critics charged that Blumenthal's work at the foundation was inappropriately politically motivated, and that during his time at the foundation, he blurred lines between the foundation and Secretary Clinton's role as Secretary of State. So Blumenthal,
Blumenthal was there at the same time that all of this Russian energy company stuff was going on, or
yes,
yeah, he was,
and so
he was playing her.
So basically, if there is ever a connection that directly ties Hillary Clinton to this Clinton Foundation money, it's going to be through him.
It's going to be Sidney Blumenthal going to various operatives and saying and later on goes to Steele. So Sidney Blumenthal, the Clinton Global Initiative, the Clinton Foundation are all dealing with all of these payments and Russian businesses. And Carter Page probably pops up on the radar. And that dossier that Christopher Steele wrote probably was written by Sidney Blumenthal. So, and then that dossier was then used to start the Mueller investigation. The Mueller investigation eventually starts uncovering Papadopoulos. It uncovers all the things that everybody kind of knew about Manafort that happened back in 2006. It had, you know, the obstruction charges are part of the reason that the whole thing was started by the people inside of the federal government. And so it's all starting to come into focus. And what we have said from the very beginning about this entire investigation, it is that there is no there. This is a wide dragnet to get the members of the administration to fall for perjury or obstruction.
Yeah, they're trying to get a process charge, basically.
A process charge, exactly. And remember back in the early days of this, when we were covering this, it was... You had this because we've been following this from the very beginning because, you know, we read 4chan and we've seen the nexus of all this. So
I remember reading the first.
I can't believe 4chan is that big of a factor in U.S. news now.
It is.
That's where I first read the first dossier.
I cannot believe that.
We would not have been able to follow the origins of this dossier back when it was a big deal.
It was literally posted on 4chan before it.
Right.
I mean, I understand that but just what 4chan is and what it turned into, but my God, the gutter of the internet.
You had John McCain, who obviously is no friend of Donald Trump, taking this dossier, giving it to the, you know, it was leaked to the press. It was given to Comey by McCain.
And Evan McMullen, don't forget.
Right. And so you
had FBI.
You've had basically this nexus of Blumenthal, Bruce Orr, and his wife, Comey. They're all involved in it. Peter Strzok, they're all involved in all this.
And that bounced around forever, too.
Right.
Nobody took it seriously. They just ended up using it.
So there's a guy named Charles Ortel, and I don't know how legitimate he is or not, but I saw this on Zero Hedge, and I thought this was a decent summation of everything that's going on. And it's called, so Charles Ortel, just based on a quick glance, is a researcher whose life mission is to bring down the Clintons. He's like the keeper.
Sounds like a good man to me.
He's the keeper of the Clinton machine info. So he writes, Mueller, Comey, Rosenstein, and Ray gave the Clinton Foundation a pass during the Bush years, and now people are asking why. Like Hercule Poirot, the ace detective in Agatha Christie's mystery Death on the Nile, Donald Trump quickly grasped that the widespread conspiracy against his presidency was far more than random campaign felonies by political hacks. Not lost in the weeds like obstructionists, candidate Trump must have suspected senior elements within the IRS, FBI, and DOJ would fear his candidacy more than any other. Let's not... The Trump 8D chess theory, okay. Right.
Clearly. Well, I mean, if you look at it objectively, you can see everyone's still... I mean, it goes back to Clinton.
Right.
First Clinton presidency.
They probably, I mean...
They've been in the DOJ and the FBI for 20 years.
They've had the ability to do oppo research on everybody for a long time. So when Trump started to pull ahead, I'm sure that's when they focused on, like...
Especially since he was critical ahead of time.
But, like, they feared his campaign from the... I mean, in that respect, they feared everyone's campaign from the beginning.
Right. Are you saying that Clinton's feared?
He's arguing. He just read a quote where the guy is saying that the Clintons feared Trump's campaign from the beginning, as if like.
Well, they probably feared more that they would be exposed.
It's implying that they took it more seriously than anyone else from the beginning, and I don't think they did. I don't think anyone took it seriously until the end.
No, I mean, the WikiLeaks exposed that they wanted Trump because they thought he was the weakest.
And they could walk over him.
He did. He had the weakest fundamentals of any candidate in American history that won the presidency, maybe in modern times of any presidential candidate. I mean, I can't think of, other than a Libertarian Party president, I mean, if you look at his campaign structure, it's the Libertarian Party campaigns. Like,
he had the most out-of-nowhere kind of a campaign.
Right.
It's like, how he won is just a testament to how awful Hillary Clinton was as a candidate.
Absolutely.
Right, so... Hillary Clinton, for certain, would never unpack the sordid history of scandals missed and covered up back to 93 or even earlier. She was the insurance policy for the swamp. So an investigation into her manifest mishandling of classified information on her private email server was bottled up. The primaries were rigged in her favor, and it was full speed ahead to the White House. Until that did not happen, thanks to a million of forgotten men and women who made their votes count. On November 9th, President-elect Trump likely understood that numerous suspects would plot against him, including some individuals he might once have thought were true allies. So a political neophyte seems to have laid traps, even nominating Rod Rosenstein to take the powerful position of deputy attorney, standing down as Rosenstein selected his mentor, Robert Mueller, to serve as special counsel investigating Russian collusion, even as Mueller packed his team with openly biased partisans. Again, Donald Trump's so brilliant that I know that there's some people in his orbit who are probably...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're super savvy, I'm sure.
Right.
But yeah, I don't think that Donald Trump himself sat down and like...
Well, you have to remember, too.
Like, he's Charlie from that episode of Always Sunny. Like, he's putting it all together
on the
wall.
It's a beautiful mind.
Well,
right?
You have to remember, Donald Trump was getting intelligence this entire time as a candidate.
Sure.
And there's also the Navy admiral who broke rank and went to Trump Tower and told Trump what was going on.
So, a lot of this stuff is, it smells like Roger Stone. Roger Stone is somebody who understands who these people are and how they operate. And so some of the 8D gamesmanship could be Roger. So fortunately for Trump and unfortunately for his enemies, there are records, and now the general public is coming to see these documents closely, even as Democrats and the blinkered media elites refuse to see the obvious. CNN could not have spent more time today. Jake Tapper, whom I love, was bemoaning the fact that nobody's really covering the domestic abuser that was, you know, John Kelly's doorkeeper for Trump. And they're like, how could John Kelly needs fired? Like, there's really not enough news value in a guy that beat his wife and has been fired once everybody found out about it. Like, what's the news value in it? You just want to, again, diminish the Trump administration as opposed to talking about this possible giant. Like, we could use some journalism on this. Like, we could use a special counsel on this.
If
you're for the Russian investigation and finding out if there's fire around that smoke. You, if you're intellectually honest, should be for a special counsel on this.
This will not be taken seriously by the media at large, let's say the Associated Press or something, until Congress does an investigation.
Yeah. I mean,
because right now it's just running off of Fox News, and no one takes Fox News seriously when it comes to reporting about Republicans. So until Congress is like, whoa, there's evidence here, we need to investigate this, no one's going to take it seriously.
This is such a huge and widespread...
Yeah,
shit. I mean, you're talking about 8 years worth of shit going on.
And this is what if this is as bad as it seems, as we describe it, like if this is the Tom Clancy style conspiracy of power kind of thing, then there's no telling who in the Democratic Party is involved.
Right.
And
we'll get to that.
But like, you know, that's the problem with theories coming through leaks and all this kind of stuff. Like, you don't really have you get a picture. Like a one angle of something that's huge, and you don't know.
Which, again, Donald Trump can declassify whatever
everything,
he wants.
Yeah.
Everything. And what I think is going to happen, the Democrats have their own memo, and what the Democrats are going to do is they're going to release a bunch of information with a ton of redactions. And so there's going to be a tremendous amount of redactions from the Democrats on these memos that they release, and they're going to stack these documents with stuff that legitimately must be classified from the security state's point of view. And so because they want the black lines, it's right. Purely showmanship. And so if they can get a ton of black lines, what that does is that makes us go, oh, there must be a lot more here that we don't know. There must be something about Carter Page that's really bad.
That's the thing about these memos that are creating
reasonable doubt.
Yeah, but these memos that are coming out are memos about a memo.
Right.
They won't actually declassify. The FISA court won't even give them the information. Is what's
right
here, Congress. They won't even give Congress the information.
Here's a prediction. If Trump is really actually as savvy as all of these people, this guy is trying to say, is why hasn't he declassified all this stuff if it could basically exonerate him and make Clinton go to jail, more or less, is why not wait until he's up for re-election?
Because he needs to do it. He needs to do it through Congress. That's the only way this will happen.
Well,
if he does that, declassification
of documents. He literally could just say all of these things, release them.
The Republicans and the administration are handling this all right because Donald Trump has such low credibility. Nobody believes that anything he ever says is the truth. And so if it looks like the administration is overtly partisan. But it is overtly partisan. Let's not get it wrong. Like the Republicans, like that Nunez memo left a lot of stuff out that was, you know, it wasn't a fair and balanced look, but it was damaging, you know, the Mueller investigation, even though it didn't even mention the Mueller investigation, really. So it is all of this is inherently partisan, which is a good thing. Like, for all the one-state rhetoric of libertarians where we say they're all the same, like, you need warring political factions in a republic
for this reason. Yeah, this is how, you know, sunshine through,
right.
Like, people want to rip each other's heads off.
You're
like,
using the incentives that people have against each other.
They hate each other so much that they're willing to sacrifice the overall apparatus if it means that their side wins.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so what you're really seeing right now is how politics operates at the highest levels of our government.
Behind closed doors.
This is all of the stuff Alex Jones has been talking about forever.
Except the gay frogs and the juicy juice and stuff.
Right, all that stuff. But like the networks that he's always talked about of power are being completely exposed. You're getting a great look at how our government operates. And I think what the best outcome of all of this is that Hillary Clinton does go to prison. Because what that will do, or at least there's an investigation into all this. And yes, there's going to be the short-term problem of people not trusting the intelligence community. But let's be honest, why should we?
They led us to war on faulty premise. Right. There needs to be a deep throat with evidence that goes to, like, just like a all the president's men style thing. To get a news story out that's well-sourced with a high-ranking person that they don't say who it is, but they have evidence. They know that he's a good source. You know, all the president's men, but with this situation.
Well, because they say there's a theory that there is one right now.
There's going to be
somebody who's not talked about at all in any of this.
A refreshing of the tree of liberty with the blood of tyrants. I think we're at a seminal moment where if it's done right and people pay attention, we can make a blow against government corruption in a very significant way because we're seeing the corruption and we can do something about it. We see how the security state is being used in immoral ways and
illegal
ways.
Watergate was great.
Absolutely.
Because all that was happening, and Watergate made it so that it stopped happening as much.
Right.
The fact that it was happening was sad, but you know, the only way you stop these things is through sunshine. These people don't think about it. It's like there's two types of morality. There's you don't do it because it's wrong, and then you don't do it because you're afraid you get caught. Those are the kinds of people who will do it until they get caught, and then they're sorry.
Right.
And
try to cover it up.
That's what Watergate was. That's what this is probably. They know it's wrong. They do it anyway, and they get caught, and now they're sorry for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's – I mean, it's
– as long as Americans continue to play the partisan game and, like – Okay, as long as Democrats excuse this bad behavior and Republicans excuse Republican bad behavior, this stuff's going to continue and we'll all just fight about it. But we need some honest Democrats to step up and say, you know what, the Clintons need to be the sacrificial lamb because for 30 years they've made us look like fools. And, you know, I saw someone today arguing, oh, maybe this will be the 800th time that you'll get Hillary Clinton. It's like, at what point do you, as a faithful Democrat who is an intelligent person, not stop and go, there's a problem with these people. It's time to get to the bottom of it instead of just saying, this is just Fox News doing ratings.
Well, let's
bullshit.
Not forget that political machines are literally what the Democrat Party has been since Boss Tweed.
Right.
I mean,
of course.
Like, that's how the party
that's
operates.
How they operate. Right.
Like,
so
you like to point out that the Republican Party's monolithic, but the Democratic Party is just as monolithic, if not more so. And I mean, Bernie Sanders was, you know, quote, the Ron Paul of the left, and he got every bit as worked over as Ron did.
Well, Sanders is a problem and a gift to the party in a couple ways, because Sanders is the first person to kind of take over the soul of, like, there's the, here's how it works. Like, the Republicans are very top down. Like, there has always been a coalescing around central philosophies. Like, you may quibble on the policy points, and you may, you know, 75% of the time if you're a Republican agree with 75% of Republican ideals or the presidential candidate. You know, you can look at a John McCain and go, I have a problem with that guy, but I'm with him 75% of the time, and he's not Barack Obama, so I'm going to vote for him. It's coalesced around an ideology where the Democrats are a coalition party. They coalesce around the idea of gaining political power to spread that political power.
Their game is winning.
To spread that power out to these different groups. Bernie Sanders is the first person to really, like, bring an ideology, and because millennials and in the digital age, the Democratic Party's starting to act like Bernie Sanders, and you have to be that 75% with Bernie Sanders to be a viable candidate. And I think that's just death for the Democrats, because if you're going to coalesce around, I mean,
it's Bernie, either him or Elizabeth Warren. I think it'll be Elizabeth Warren.
Bernie Sanders is actually better than a Kamala Harris, because Kamala Harris is all identity politics. And as long as they, as Ben Shapiro pointed out today, like, as long as Democrats only focus on identity politics, they're going to lose. They're just going to push the more moderate people into the Republican camp on things like kneeling in the NFL. And Bernie Sanders actually gives them an economic message. And I think that's part of why he was so popular, is because Bernie Sanders is the only Democrat with an economic message.
I think Elizabeth Warren would be probably more likely to, if she runs in 2020 or whatever, I think she's got a better chance than Bernie Sanders, because she has the same message as him.
But she's fundamentally unlikable.
I don't know, though.
There's something about Bernie Sanders that is moderately likable.
That online spasm of support that Bernie Sanders got from millennials was Elizabeth Warren's first. That all came out of her Senate campaign in Massachusetts. She was like, every one of them was like, you know, this girl's fighting the big banks and the corporations and stuff. and that was her message. And then when it turned out she wasn't going to run for president and Bernie Sanders was, it all moved over to him. But their message is really the exact same.
But she identified the market, and he sold a better product, in my opinion. Bernie Sanders can be he doesn't take himself seriously. There is a humility around Bernie Sanders. Like, when you would watch him on, what was that show on Showtime that we liked?
The circus. Yeah.
You were like, okay, this guy, he's like a serious person, but he doesn't take himself too seriously. He'll allow Larry David to make fun of him to his face. Like, you don't get that with Elizabeth Warren. Like, she comes across whiny. And, like, she's so, I don't know.
Well, that's
like,
all her Indian blood.
To us.
I know, but Bernie Sanders, you can at least look at him and go, I respect that he's trying to do what he thinks is right for all of us.
Oh, I don't at all. I don't believe Bernie Sanders.
I think he's a huge liar. I think he's a total opportunist. I think he's a lazy loser. But But my point is, for your average person, they look at Bernie Sanders and they see the messages for all of us, whereas Elizabeth Warren comes across as, I'm doing this for my constituency.
I don't think that she got a big enough national recognition. Like, Bernie Sanders was on the debate stage, so you can say that. Elizabeth Warren never got there because she didn't run.
Right.
And I think that when push comes to shove, she'll be a better candidate for president that taps into that same group that you're talking about. I don't know. That's just my opinion. But, I mean, she could even bridge that identity politics gap to some extent. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the old guard would be on her side because she could... I mean, why? I mean, the same. I mean, Clinton.
You're both wrong. It's going to be Cory Booker. We all know.
Cory Booker I like. Is possible as well.
Yeah. He checks all the boxes.
He's okay.
Especially the black one.
He's okay. I don't like him.
No, he doesn't matter.
He is okay.
As a person, he's likable.
Oh, yeah. He seems like he's a great guy in person. But his big thing, he's not going to run on the reasons that we like him for. Like criminal justice reform and stuff, that'll be like a 5-second bit of some speech on his campaign.
Right.
That's not going to define his campaign.
As long as the Democrats continue to push identity politics and that is the central message.
That's all they push.
And intersectional politics. They're going to lose.
Yeah, I think America's. I do think America's getting tired of it.
We're done. We're done with it.
I think. I do think in general that it's kind of reached its tipping point, and people are like, all right.
Even a socially liberal person like myself, who while I am a Christian, I believe that the government shouldn't have any business in crafting any moral legislation. I believe that people should be allowed to live their lives as they see fit. And so I think I'm pretty liberal on a lot of social issues, and I just go, I'm not like, you're pushing me more and more right. Like, you're making me more conservative, because I don't want to be associated with your lunacy. So let's continue with this article, because there's some other good points in here. Charles Ortel writes at Zero Hedge. Now that the appetizers are served, the Nunez memo and the Democratic counter memo are morsels, mere morsels, America deserves to read as much as possible of Inspector General Michael Horowitz's forthcoming report, so that all who choose to think for themselves can understand just how profoundly America's justice system has been corrupted since 1992. What is Inspector General Michael Horowitz's report?
Horowitz's report? I don't think I've read it.
Okay. Well, it's not out yet. But he's the inspector general doing a report.
I think he's doing an independent report on the entire. I don't know if he was the email or if he's. I was probably going to tie it all together.
Can you look that up while I finish reading this? That'd be tits. As Congress and the new digital media now do jobs abandoned by the former intrepid investigative journalist in the mainstream outfits, which is a great point. Like, imagine, like, as I'm reading all this stuff today, imagine if we didn't have Fox News or Zero Hedge or alternative media outlets that are willing to cover this stuff. We Are Libertarians will give you a fair shake across any spectrum trying to put this stuff together. Like, where do you hear the kind of stuff that we do here at We Are Libertarians, where you do long-form, broken out, here's all the pieces, here's what all the sides say? You don't get that anywhere because it doesn't sell well on CNN. And so I think that's really important.
Horowitz uncovered the Strzok and Page text messages.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So then...
Who is this?
He's the Inspector General.
Okay.
Inspector General of what department?
The DOJ.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so an inspector general, every department in the federal government has an inspector general, and they are the independent investigator. So if there is a legal issue that arises, the IG goes in and starts investigating. And if he's investigating the DOJ, then that'll
the
be...
He's like the head of internal affairs.
Yeah, he's the IA, the internal affairs. You know, when Stabler punches a perp on Law and Order SVU, and IA comes down and investigates him. That's what the IG does. So he'll carry a lot more weight than a Republican or a Democratic Party memo, because we can pretend that there's all these people are non-biased, like people that work at the Department of Justice and the FBI are without bias at the highest levels of government. That's the biggest thing that's coming out of all this is it's all bull crap. Everybody has biases. Everybody has, you know, as fair and balanced as I try to be, like, I have biases. Everybody has them. You listening have biases, and you just try to engage in higher thought and weigh your biases against the information that you're processing. And so that's why a Robert Mueller, who I genuinely have heard nothing but good things about, is somebody who tries, except from Tad Western, somebody who tries to, lay aside as many biases as possible and give a fair shake to people.
Well, he should have recused himself then from the... investigation.
So we are now in a real-life Game of Thrones, connecting the dots, the evidence that matters. For almost 18 years, Team Clinton, Team Bush, and Team Obama have allowed a small library project in Arkansas to mushroom into the largest set of international charity frauds ever attempted. The Why is Team Bush included in that listing? Because even the Democrats lost the fateful 2000 election. Somehow the Clintons resisted prosecution for their crimes. Who shuttered the investigations of these early Clinton felonies from 01 to 05? Starting in 2001, the FBI, a U.S. attorney, and a grand jury began considering evidence of fraud and public corruption involving Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. To see how we know this, visit the FBI vault. By September 4th, 2001, Robert Mueller was FBI director, a position he held for 12 years as the Clinton Foundation frauds ballooned globally in magnitude and negative consequence. By 2002, James Comey, then U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, led the quote-unquote prosecution against the Clinton Foundation and Bill Clinton until December 2003, when he was promoted to Deputy Attorney General, a position he held until August 2005. From 01 to 05, Rod Rosenstein led DOJ's efforts to ensure enforcement of tax cases such as the Clinton charity frauds. And from September 2003 through May 2005, Christopher Wray, the FBI director currently, led the DOJ's criminal investigation concentrating on fraud cases including Enron. The American people certainly deserve to understand how Mueller, Comey, Rosenstein, and Wray missed for so many years the multiple and large and obvious frauds and corruptions centrally involving the Clinton Foundation, its trustees, its professional advisors, its significant advisors. Unless these two have been bleach bit, a reference to the destruction of Clinton emails.
She wiped it with a cloth, remember?
Right. Unless these two have been bleach bit, all of the records of the first botched investigation into the Clinton Foundation need to be aired with we the people. When that happens, America will see how badly the muddy waters in Arkansas filled with low ground along the Potomac River, making it the putrid swamp that desperately needs draining today. In Washington, D.C., in state capitals, and in city halls, the punditry drives conservative Republicans from office whenever there are even the slightest appearances of impropriety. The same conga line of expert ethicist is only too happy to ignore criminal conspiracies perpetrated by Democrats and moderate Republicans. Mueller, Comey, Rosenstein, and Wray need to start answering pointed questions under oath. When they do, many heads will roll and the swamp will finally begin to recede. I thought that was an interesting point of view. I've not heard people really say, hey, I didn't even know there was a 2001 to 2005 investigation of the Clinton Foundation.
This strikes me as like, you know, in The Dark Knight where they get the one person in the mob, and because they're associated with all these people, they're able to get all of the mobsters in one trial. This strikes me as like what they're trying to have happen here is they get one guy or one or two people,
right,
and next thing you know, you have like 300 people standing in a courtroom, and they're asking for a plea of whether or not you're guilty or innocent of corruption charges.
Yeah, and maybe that's the wrong approach. Maybe small pieces, but who knows? It's.
I mean, this
is happening.
This has only gotten better. It's only been a year. Mm-hmm. Like, it's only gotten better since
Watergate took 20 months. Something. It took a long time.
Right, but it's only been.
And Watergate was literally not as involved. It didn't span.
Right.
It didn't
span. We're talking 15 years.
It was a break-in and a cover-up, and that was what Watergate was.
This is multiple crimes, multiple cover-ups.
Way more people.
All right, so we'll keep an eye on this. This is not going to be the last time that we talk about it, but certainly something for everybody here.
This will be a movie. So, if this ends up happening the way we think.
This will be a series. This won't be a movie. Yeah. This is too large. This is Game of Thrones style.
They had a series. It's called House of Cards.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
If they find out somebody died, like if
what Clinton, are you talking about? We have the body.
Seth Rich.
Who is Seth
Vince
Rich?
Vince Foster.
Yeah.
All right, so before you guys got here, I was watching Rand Paul. I'm going to take Rand Paul's House floor speech, put it on the Raw Audio Politics podcast feed. Go to your podcatcher, get the Raw Audio Politics. That's where I basically take audio that I want to listen to. I took the State of the Union and the response, and so when I want to hear a piece of audio, like I want to re-listen to Rand Paul's speech on the Senate floor tonight, I will put that in that feed so you can listen there. And he was talking about the new budget. The new budget, this bipartisan budget, ooh.
Ooh, yeah. Love me some budget.
They love that. They love that word.
What is it? What George Carlin said that whenever you see bipartisan, it's a bigger between the left and the right, a bigger conspiracy is being concocted to fuck you.
Right.
You're getting two dicks instead of one?
Yeah. I just figured it out. Your mic, Creighton, is being weird. I don't know if it's your mic, your cord, or what, but your volume keeps going up and down, so I apologize to the listeners. So, Veronique de Rougie from Reason wrote...
De Rougie?
Yeah, wrote this article. Grab that mic and use that mic for me, please.
Mic swap.
Just take that whole cord and move it over for me. The Senate budget deal proves Republicans love big government spending.
What?
Yeah, I know. It's weird.
Who would have thought?
She writes, the bipartisan budget deal that senators proclaimed so proudly yesterday would add $300 billion over 2 years to discretionary spending, not counting emergency funds and other add-ons. It would yet again burst the budget caps that the Republicans negotiated in 2011 during a debt ceiling deal. Remember, that was when sequester happened. Yeah. Now that you're just way low.
They hate the sequester. Both sides do.
Yeah, the
Republicans are always like, oh, we can't spend as much on the Defense Department.
Explain the sequester, please.
It was supposed to be a whip to ensure that they passed a continuing resolution. It had to be something to do with like enough agreement. Like, I had to have some certain number of votes or something. But regardless, it was like an automatic reduction in spending increase.
Right.
And I say that very particular. I choose my words carefully there. It's not a spending cut. If you listen to politicians talk about it, they'll say cut spending. It was a spending cut. It wasn't. It reduced the rate of growth of spending. And I said this on the last time I was on here, but in Washington speak, there's three types of spending. There's spending increase, which means you spend more than the projection of the Congressional Budget Office. There's spending freeze, which means that you spend as much as the projected increase in spending by the Congressional Budget Office. And then there's spending cuts, which means that you spend less than the projected increase in spending by the Congressional Budget Office. But if you look at point A and point B, you're increasing the amount of money you spent. You're just not increasing it as fast as the CBO said you would.
Right.
They call that a spending cut. So... you have to be careful when it comes to Washington speak. So the sequester never cut a dime. It just reduced the rate of growth, and it reduced it across the board, I believe, including military spending, and that's why the Republicans hated it, and the Democrats hated it because it's on other things. So they've hated it for a long time, which is why it's great. I mean, I'd take a reduction in spending increase over not having it, but this budget just showed that they don't care. Both sides want to spend out the wazoo. They really don't have any semblance of austerity in their minds.
So she wrote, this week's deal resembles those earlier ones in many ways, except it's even worse. Military spending caps were $549 billion. The Senate wants to jack that up to $629 billion, with an additional $71 billion for war supplementals and emergency funding.
And didn't the Pentagon audit just show that they had,
$3 trillion.
Yeah, they just lost it.
The total for this year would be a cozy $700 billion on military spending, rising to $716 next year. In exchange, Republicans get to increase military spending.
Which they always want to do, because God knows we need 16 more aircraft carriers if we're going to be protected from something.
So here's what the Democrats got. Democrats get to hike non-military spending by $131 billion over 2 years.
Ooh.
The spending cap in this area stood at $516 in the 2018 fiscal year. It will now be $579 billion, with an extra $12 billion for war supplementals. So the Democrats get to get an extra $12 million of their own for war spending.
Yay.
That results in a sweet balance.
The words military-industrial complex come to mind.
Right. All this extra money will be spending on largely bipartisan priorities such as infrastructure and the opioid crisis. The deal will probably pass in the House despite the objections.
They said the opioid crisis.
Yep.
Like,
right.
The opioid crisis is because marijuana is illegal. Like, you don't need any money to fight the opioid crisis. You need to spend $0 and just legalize marijuana.
Well, you can literally make money by taxing it.
Yeah. Like.
So, Ernst & Young. What's the problem with military spending? So Ernst & Young, and listen, you got to go listen to that Rand Paul speech. It's so good, and he outlined some stuff. Like, he's talking about in Afghanistan, we built this, 45, we were scheduled to build a natural gas station.
Yeah, the gas
station. For cars. and it was going to cost $500,000. It ended up costing $45 million.
That's cheap.
They built a gas station in Afghanistan for cars that ran on natural gas. Have you ever heard of such a thing? No, and neither has anyone in Afghanistan. And so they realized, well, we spent this $45 million on natural gas station. There's no cars, so we better buy the Afghanis in the area some cars that run on natural gas. And the whole goal of the entire project...
Sounds like Blue Indy.
Right. Well, the whole entire project was based on the premise that we need to reduce the carbon footprint of the Afghanis. Listen, it's not our fucking job to do that, is basically what Rand Paul said. He said the goal of the military is to kill the enemy. It is not to nation build and reduce the carbon footprint of Afghanistan.
I'd be curious to see what their carbon footprint is.
So it gets
is it
better.
Even top 200?
Right. It gets better than that. Well, you know, camel farts have a... That was racist. I apologize, but
no,
I don't care who you are. That's
they're
funny.
Goats.
Right. Go farts. Go
yeah, the, it's the mountains, man.
Yeah,
it's more mountain
desert.
Yeah.
So
racist.
So they buy them the cars. Well, they don't have any money to buy the. So the U.S. military, the federal government, you paid for credit cards, and we pay the balance for their gas.
What if they run a?
You are buying
interest.
You are buying gas. Wouldn't it be nice if the government gave you a credit card so you could buy your gas? I spent $40 last night. So,
well, you're a sucker.
Yeah.
This strikes me as, you ever seen the Archer episode where
yes.
they go to the some kind, I don't remember exactly what country it was, they're drug cartel basically, and they're working on behalf of the FBI and the
yes.
or the CIA, I'm sorry. And it ends up that they have an argument at the end of the episode. Why did you do this? Why did you do this? Like, well, we need to spend all of our money that we were budgeted. Like, why? It's like, well, if we don't spend it all, then we won't get an increase for next
yep.
year.
Yeah.
And, like, that's exactly what's going on. Like, they're like, well, we got $45 million. What are we going to do with it? I don't know. Just buy some natural gas cars.
Right. That's exactly right. But that's probably what happened. So they're doing a test case for the full audit of the Pentagon's $700 billion annual budget.
Annual.
So Ernst & Young Jeez. Conducted this audit, and the audit completed in December found misstatements on the DLA's, Defense Department, books totaling $465 million. Another $384 million lacks sufficient documentation. And sometimes had no documentation.
Lost gas receipts.
Right. No documentation at all.
And they don't even, Pentagon doesn't even get a full audit, right? So whatever they audited the Pentagon, which it isn't like a full-fledged audit.
They,
it's
have,
just
they have a
like,
black budget.
No, they claim that they're too big to audit.
Right. Yeah. So it's like the Fed, where the Fed gets audited. They don't actually get everything audited. They're just the stuff that they want to tell us about.
So Politico got a hold of this on Monday, and it shows the Pentagon's Defense Logistics Agency described it as the military's Walmart because it is responsible for processing supplies and equipment, lacks a paper trail for millions of dollars of spending, making it impossible for auditors to determine how funds were used. Across the board, its financial management is so weak that its leaders and oversight bodies have no reliable way to track the huge sums it is responsible for.
And we just gave them, like, an extra, what, $300 million or something was their
right.
increase?
Yep.
Well, you've got to, you know, it's hard to keep track of money when, you, when you've got it by cash by the pallet load and you fly it over to Iran and you just drop it on people.
Have you guys seen War Dogs?
Oh, yeah.
The movie War Dogs with Jonah Hill?
Jonah Hill.
Yeah. Watch that movie and try not to be pissed off because it's a true story. It's these two high school friends start ripping off the federal government and end up in
they become arms dealers.
Yeah. It's a great movie.
Yeah, this strikes me as, why did we need all this extra money? Well, one, it looks good for a congressman to go back to his district and say, look at all this, I support the troops, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And then you have the literally the military-industrial complex. You have people whose business it is to sell guns, tanks, arms.
Raytheon, Boeing.
Jets, fighter jets that will never see a single flight. That's their job, so
right.
they need to make sure demand stays up, so they lobby Congress to give them money to build these things that, you know, just for the sake of their business.
In 10 years, we'll sell them for
right.
$1 million.
What was the fighter jet that the Pentagon even said they didn't want, but Congress said we got to build anyway? And,
yeah.
Like, never going to see a single flight, but they spent, like, billions of dollars on it anyway.
Well, until now, Devin Nunes' only achievement in the House... The only thing that he's really been fighting for is to keep a military base open in his district, I think. I mean, it's they don't want the congressmen don't want to decrease military spending because it's bad for their districts. Like here in my district, we have the accounting department, DFAS, the second largest building, military building outside of the Pentagon, although I think they just built a bigger one. And basically, this is in Lawrence, Indiana, where all of the accounting for the military is done. And, you know, so you think Andre Carson's going to want to limit spending on how many people? And, like, the last girl I dated was trying, her sister worked there. She said she just plays solitaire all day. They have nothing to do there. They have probably 30% more employees than they really need.
I mean,
okay.
This and the thing is, boy, what's so infuriating about this is whenever you even bring this up amongst anyone on any Republican, it's all about safety, security, fighting terrorism.
Right.
It's like we need to make sure our troops have all they need and, you know, support freedom and fight for freedom. And it's like you either have to pay barely any attention, you have to just be so. Have such a cognitive dissonance that you're literally just parroting whatever press release you read today.
Right.
But that's not what happens with all of this money. The Pentagon,
the majority of it's
wastes
wasted.
So much money. Like, it wastes so much money. And you're not decreasing our ability to protect this country if you take a hard look at the finances and realize they're spending $4,000 on a screwdriver. Like, unless all of this is just bloated, not like an Independence Day. It's like, you didn't really think they spent $400 on a hammer and $7,000 on a toilet seat, did you? Because they was supposed to be hidden money to go into Area 51.
Right.
Like, unless that's literally what's happening. They're saying we're spending all this money on all this junk, and they actually have hidden bases all over the place that they're wasting all the money on. But, like, that, there's so much waste in the Pentagon that needs to be gotten rid of, and they can't do it because the minute they touch it, the minute they even reduce the rate of spending growth, they're looked at as anti-soldier, anti-freedom, anti-military, anti-everything. And that's – it's absurd. It is so absurd.
So speaking of which, President Donald Trump has asked the Pentagon to plan a grand parade of the U.S. Armed Forces in Washington this year.
Can't wait.
To celebrate military strength, officials said. The Washington Post was the first to report on this parade. Sarah Huckabee Sanders confirmed the request Tuesday evening. It's to explore a celebration that will allow Americans to show appreciation for the military. Okay. Muscular military parades are common in authoritarian countries like China and North Korea, but are not quintessentially American.
That's not fair, though, because we've done those plenty of times in America. Even Clinton did a couple.
Well, what we have done is parade celebrating military victories. Like, they're the last military parade. Was
no way he's planning this.
After
though.
Desert Storm. Why?
Because Hillary's going to prison.
Here's our throw parade for Hillary. Well, maybe we can lock her up.
She is the Trotsky.
Yep.
Maybe we can put her in a cage. Like, she can be the centerpiece. We'll put her in a cage on one of the trucks, and so everybody can throw fruit.
Yeah, it'll be
at
like
her.
The anti-Pope mobile.
Right. So the idea of the American military rolling through civilian streets is just fundamentally un-American. Yes, there have been military parades, but they've been parades in celebration of the war.
One of the oldest laws on the books is called the Posse Comitatus, mm-hmm. and it prevents the military from being used inside the borders.
Right.
It's supposed to, but like that's how old the tradition is of not
right.
parading the military around in your home is.
And
it's pretty old.
It goes back to the idea of Donald Trump's version of American exceptionalism. We are great because we are the richest country in the earth. We have the most we have the biggest military, and we have white culture.
Goddamn right.
Right, which is Tad is all for, but
I love me some military parades.
Right.
I don't like normal parades. Clowns scare me, but camo. I'm down with camo.
So clowns scare you, but not the idea of a giant military rolling through the American streets.
I will support a military parade on our streets if Michael Dukakis puts himself in a tank and goes down the parade with him.
Rick Irvine has a great point in the chat. So if you're a $10 a month Patreon subscriber, you get to watch the show live on YouTube, chat with other friends. And Rick says, we need militia parades. I agree. We need the 3% to walk right behind the U.S. military.
Well, that would just be the National Guard nowadays. It's what they say.
No, we don't want that militia. I want the getter duns and the pickup trucks paroling the border to drive up.
Because they're all assholes.
You hate
too.
Freedom. So on to our next story.
You realize how many asshurt liberals will be, though? Like how... I love it just because so many people are getting pissed off. Like, oh my God, he's turning us into North Korea.
I'm a little burnout on the do everything to tee off the left.
Oh no,
like that's a little stale for me now. It's like, all right, let's grow up and actually,
like,
you know,
can we get
govern.
To the business of governing? Yeah, I'm so with you.
No, nope.
Yeah, like there's
too many Jimmies to be wrestled.
I just the outrage is too much. I can't take them anymore. All right, so as I'm on Zero Hedge, I see this article. Inflation alert, the velocity of money has finally bottomed. I'm a regular Glenn Beck listener, and he always talks about the velocity of money.
How's your brain tumor?
He talks about it all the time. My brain tumor's great. Forget the tax Trump cuts, the Trump tax cuts, the Senate budget deal, the Fed's quantitative tightening, and the collapse in foreign buying of U.S. treasuries. After years of dormancy, the biggest catalyst for a sharp inflationary spike has finally emerged. It is none of the above, the velocity of money, which, long story short, is the speed with which money moves around.
It's
right?
Yeah, so if I put on my econ nerd hat real quick.
Yeah, basically I want you to explain what's going on with the stock market.
Well, I'm not a stock investor, so I couldn't tell you 100% on that. But I will say, as far as the velocity of money, this is an old term that goes back. I don't remember exactly who invented the equation. It's probably like Irving Fisher or something. But
Which is MV equals PG.
Right.
PQ.
So the equation is that the GDP is inversely related to, or no, directly related to... Basically, MV equals PY, where M is the measure of the money supply, V is the velocity of the money, which we're going to talk about in a second, and then the nominal GDP would be written as the price level times, which is P, times the real GDP, which is Y. So basically...
So here's what they say, okay? This implies that the unprecedented monetary base increase driven by the Fed's large money injections.
Well, hang on. Let me explain the underlying economics of why they care at all first. So this equation, MV equals PY, implies that if you increase the money supply, then you also increase GDP. Because if M goes up, let's say V doesn't change. V is the velocity of money. Let's say M goes up, the supply of money goes up, then that increase has to equal P times Y, where Y is the real GDP and P is the price level. So they say if we increase the money supply, we can also increase the GDP, which is technically true because the GDP is measured in dollars. And if V is constant or goes down, then you won't see. So basically what they want to do is they want to have the GDP go up while the price of while the price level doesn't go up, and that's basically what the Fed tries to do every day. They try and increase the supply of money and not increase prices, which they count as inflation. So for the Austrian economics nerds that listen, you'll probably argue with me: inflation. That's not the price of money, or that's not the price level. That's the number of dollars in circulation. And I do agree. That's what inflation technically is. The only way to get a general increase in prices is through increasing the money supply. Any other kind of price increase is just a result of supply and demand in one form or another, and which is healthy and fine. But the problem is that the way they measure inflation in the United States is through whether or not a aggregate of various goods and services, their average price level of those went up or not. Mm-hmm. They have a bunch of different ways of measuring it, but that's more or less what it is. So they take a bunch of things, they put them in a basket, they say, what is the average price? And if the average price between time A and time B goes up, then they say that we had some inflation. And if it goes down, we had some deflation. The problem with using that approach, though, is that it implies sort of like a stability from time A to time B of underlying supply and demand. So if at time A, the price level is at some level, then at time B, it's still at the same level. That doesn't mean that, say, demand may have gone down as well. And if demand goes down, but you increase the supply of money, you should keep, you could more or less keep the price level the same. And that is not captured in the way that they measure inflation in this country. So that's all an underlying economics thing. So the velocity of money is this idea that, which makes sense if you think about it in a big level, is that, you know, let's say the Fed prints up $1 billion and they give $1 billion to a bank in New York and say, all right, loan this out. Until they actually use that money, the price level in the economy doesn't know that that money has gone out and done anything yet. So if supply, if increase in the supply of money is what causes prices to go up, that supply of money, that there is implied in there that the money's actually being spent, that it's not just sitting in a mattress somewhere not being used. So the velocity of money was a, was an attempt to measure how fast that money is changing hands. So a hardcore Austrian would argue with you that the velocity of money is not real. It's not a real thing. And that's true, but what they're trying to capture using a mathematical equation is this idea that if money goes, if money disperse, think of it as like money hits the, you put, let's say you put some food dye in the, in one end of the pool. If the water's really cold, then the food dye isn't going to spread and color the whole pool red or whatever color it was. It's going to take a longer amount of time for that water, for that coloring to go throughout the entire pool. Whereas if it's hotter, it's going to move faster. And the idea is that money enters at one point in the economy and then it disperses out. It can disperse at a speed, quote, quote, but that's what the velocity of money is trying to reflect. But because of that equation that I mentioned earlier, if the velocity of money is going down, which they actually measure it using that equation, there's not like the only way they measure it is by solving for V. They have all the numbers for the other equation, so they just solve for V, and that's how they measure the velocity of money. But if the velocity of money is going down, while the increase in money supply is going up, then inflation should not, as far as they measure it, as a general increase in prices, shouldn't show up because there's offsetting factors. So you shouldn't see an inflation. And that's more or less what's happened since 2008, is that there hasn't been any of this giant inflation that people, that, that a lot of bears have warned about, and a lot of libertarian people, right, they've argued, like, that there should be this so much inflation because, yeah, all of this. But
Peter Schiff was warning again today that it's all going to hell, it's all about to collapse, blah,
and
blah,
he's always, he's right eventually because, right, he knows the fundamentals, but he's never good on timing.
No.
Although he was good on the mortgage backed security stuff, but The problem is if velocity of money is going down, money supply is going up, inflation shouldn't show up. But if in velocity of money ever bottoms out, ever goes flat, or if it ever starts to increase, then all of that money, that inflation should rear its head. And there's, so that's what this article is talking about, is that if the velocity of money is bottomed out, which isn't from the graph they gave me, I think that's a little, It has flattened a little bit, but like to say that it's going to trend flat is, I don't think that's a fair, based on the little big graph that they have in this article that he's reading. I don't think that's fair. But nevertheless, if the velocity of money does teeter out, then that just basically means that people aren't slowing down how fast they're spending money, and that just means, it's just saying that the money's going to be spent a little bit quicker than it had been, and you're going to see inflation because the Fed is still increasing money. That's really all it can do, is, right, increase money. So that's what a lot of investors in the stock market have been worried, that because bond rates are starting to go up, government bonds, that's another indicator that maybe there might be some inflation on the horizon, because if the bond rates start to go up, then it's just, you have to take course economics and investing and stuff. But more or less, a lot of investors are worried because 10-year bond yields have gone up. I think it was like a top was 2.88%, which has been the highest in some, mm-hmm, amount of time. And if the bond rates go up, that's supposed to be like, oh, there might be some inflation on the horizon. And then maybe this will tell people that there might be some inflation on the horizon. There's a lot of fear of inflation right now.
Right.
Because most people who are savvy on economics understand you just print money, print money, print money, you'll get inflation. It happened in the 70s, right, with the stagflation.
We're going to have to deal with all that Janet Yellen and Barack Obama did.
But it's not just Janet Yellen. This has been policy since 2008, and it's been policy a little bit before that. I mean, Alan Greenspan adjusted for the collapse of the tech bubble by keeping interest rates down, and that's where the housing market came around. And Ben Bernanke's is like, well, let's keep them low.
9/11.
They've been near zero for a long time. And in fact, the real interest rate for however long has been such that you're actually paying people to borrow money.
Right.
Like, you're not charging them money to borrow money. You're paying them to borrow money because the real interest rate is actually negative. And that's insane. And, like, that's – you can only do that for so long. Eventually, right. I mean, it makes the stock market look nice. It makes GDP numbers look nice. And it does spur people to invest in projects, take risks, invest in stuff because – It's cheap. It doesn't cost any money to go borrow any money, and so you get all of this job growth and stuff. And that's but eventually, and this is the Austrian theory of the trade cycles, that eventually people are going to realize that all of the demand for all of these projects actually isn't there. And until they realize that, you know, you're going to have great growth, but eventually it has to collapse. Eventually, and that's the Austrian theory of the trade cycle. You reduce interest rates, you print money, it malinvests capital. Capital goes into directions that it shouldn't go because there's not actually any supply and demand for those goods or services. And then when they finally figure it out, all this stuff's been built already, and you hear this, you have this gigantic tank.
Yeah, they've talked about 4-4.5% raising the Fed rates up to 4.
Yeah,
and there's also the day that it started to tank is the first day of the new Fed chair, and there's a historical precedent for the day a Fed chair takes over, the markets start to test them. And then you also had, you know, basically the Republicans saying, we're not going to do austerity in any way, shape, or form. We're done with all that noise.
Yeah, I don't think that this stock market dip that happened today that's been happening – I don't think it's the first – I could be wrong, but I don't think it's the first, like, dip of a gigantic recession.
Yeah.
I don't think it is.
I think we still have a while to go before you start to have a – this is just a correction.
Right. Correction is just 10% off of the highest gain of the
points.
So if you take a half – if you look at all the stock market closings in the last year, and then you take the highest point, which I think was like 26,000 – and you say, what is 10% below that? If you hit that 10% mark below, you're considered in correction territory.
Right.
But recession territory is two or three quarters back-to-back of negative GDP growth, and then you're in a recession. So I don't think that's going to happen. In fact, there's a lot of evidence to show that GDPs should be really high, or not really high, but it should go up because there's been a lot of job creation and stuff. Now, GDP growth does not mean economic health.
No.
GDP growth is a way that they measure the strength of the economy. But, you know, you can get GDP growth by just having the government throw billions of dollars at something and make bridges to nowhere. GDP,
China.
You have to take all of these measurements with a grain of salt. Now, GDP is the most popular way to show the strength of an economy, and they will – and a lot of, you know, talking heads and economists, well, that's all they'll talk about is, well, GDP growth is strong. It's strong. It's strong. They say the economy is healthy. But unless you have a understanding of fundamentally of what production even is, not just the numbers, but like even what production is, you can be tricked by GDP numbers. And like you said with China, like China literally builds cities of apartments that are vacant because it makes their GDP look nice.
Yeah. Well, yeah, their GDP is based on construction, and so they have all these ghost cities. Go look up the Vice China ghost city video where they basically go and tour one of them. It's hilarious.
But anyway.
Tad, where are you putting your money?
I've been investing in cryptocurrencies, you know. I pretty much liquidated all my assets, and I bought a bunch of shit coins and lost my ass.
Did you?
Yep, I'm poor now. I live in a tent.
What is Bitcoin right now?
I have no idea.
I think it was like it went six or seven.
It's down 421 in the past day.
It was at like 8,000. It was at like
it's at 79.55 right now.
Yeah, it was around 8,000.
It was down in the 5,000 range the other day. But yeah, the Bitcoin bubble seems to be popping. But you never know; it could fly back up again. I don't make any predictions on stocks because I don't know left or right from investing or what the signals are. So do not trust. I'm not going to make any kind of prediction on what the stock market will do because I have no clue.
I will. It's all going to shit. Buy canned beans.
Buy canned beans. Food insurance is incredibly important. No.
Make sure you got a Berkey water filter and a bunch of ammo.
All right, so I said I would talk about gerrymandering in this episode. For those of you who are gerrymandering nerds like me, we're just about done here, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on it. But I do want to mention a Supreme Court case that is incredibly important. It was argued on October 3rd of last year. It's Gill versus Whitford. Whitford is an attorney in Wisconsin who sued the state of Wisconsin over their redistricting. And 538 has done a great podcast series on redistricting. If you want to look that up and listen to it, the Wisconsin one was unbelievable. And you have the Wisconsin legislature basically going behind closed doors. It used to be very transparent and open and everybody had a say. But then during the time when you had Scott Walker come in and you remember all the rallies in the state house and people camping out over right to work, during that period is when they redrew the maps. And they had this secretive process where you had two members of the house and they basically like drew all the maps and they brought in all the legislators and showed them their district, but nobody was allowed to see any of the maps, and they were all supposed to sign NDAs and say you know these may not be the official maps. It was just very secretive and weird. And then they had elections and Democrats won a majority of the vote but didn't win a majority of the seats. And gerrymandering, and so in, there's been several different cases, and the political gerrymandering in a 1986 court case was outlawed, and then it was tested again in 2004, and Anthony Kennedy at the time, it was 4-4-1, and Anthony Kennedy was the abstention, and he basically said, coincidentally enough, the 1986 case was for here in Indiana for when the Democrats tried to steal the legislature.
What?
Yeah. And then the 2004 case, Anthony Kennedy said, I sympathize with your plight. I do think that there is gerrymandering going on here, but the court, without some sort of standard, can't be the ones to rule on this, because we don't want, and John Roberts echoed this argument again in October, the court doesn't want to be the one that is consistently deciding elections. You need to be the ones to decide this. So in the 60s, there was also an outlawing by the Supreme Court on racial gerrymandering. So political gerrymandering, basically the way that the court has ruled is that there's going to be political gerrymandering. We understand that. But you shouldn't do it, and we don't want to get involved in it. And we don't have any test to figure out how to do that. So the lawyer who argued that 2004 case got involved in Wisconsin with this other lawyer, Whitford. And Whitford was basically saying, you know, why do we have 49% representation when we have more than 50% of the vote? Representation is incredibly important. Let's come up with a standard. And so they've come up with something called the efficiency gap. And they are arguing that they can prove that they can limit, essentially, not prove, but limit the amount of gerrymandering that goes on by something called the efficiency gap. Chris Galt's not feeling well. That's why he didn't show up. So feel better, Chris. So
you get some of that plutonium-67.
I think that Chris Galt was poisoned.
He went home and drank too much fluoride.
Yep.
All right, so let's play this. This is from Radiolab's Robert Krulwich on WNYC, and it's a great explanation of a very complicated theory.
You know the feeling. It's election day, right, where you live, and most of your friends and most of your neighbors and pretty much everybody in your district favors the same party. So you can vote, but if you don't vote, you know your side's going to win, which makes your vote, how do I put this delicately, a little unnecessary. Or maybe it's the opposite. So many people in your area like the other party, you are such a pitiable minority that whether you vote or not, you know you're going to lose today. So either way, going to vote seems a waste of your time. In a way, the game's been fixed. With computers these days, state legislatures can take a state where there's 60% red voters and 40% blue voters. And if you draw the lines this way, The Blues win every district in the state, a clean sweep, even though they aren't 100% of the voters. Or you could draw the lines this way. And in this case, the Reds win 3 out of 5 seats, though they're the minority. And it'll stay this way for 10 years until the next census. So here's the question. Is this legal? Well, the Supreme Court has signaled it might not be. If there's a clear and neutral way to show that a political party has rigged the game on its own behalf. And when you consider how much political power depends on these lines, the stakes here are enormous. So two professors created a simple formula, a mathematical way to say the game has been rigged. Basically, they ask, how many voters in this state could say, yesterday, my vote didn't matter? Or, putting it another way, how many votes does the winner really need to win? A lot of votes, they say, are wasted. Now, what do they mean by wasted? Well, if you get one more vote than the next guy, then you win. If you get two more votes or 10,000 more votes, you don't need them. Those are extra. The professors call them wasted votes. If you vote for a losing candidate, well, you haven't won anything, so in effect, your vote is wasted there. So that's what they do. They pile up this category called wasted votes, and then they create what they call the efficiency gap formula. Now, I don't expect you to grab this in one gulp, but here's what they do. Take the number of wasted votes for the winner and for the loser. Now, subtract the smaller number from the larger number, like this. You get a net number. Divide that number by the total number of votes cast. If the proportion of wasted votes is too high, something's wrong here. Generally, if the difference is 8%, if that gap, that line there is 8% or more, that's a red flag. In Wisconsin, in the 2012 elections, the efficiency gap was 13.3%. The lower courts say this is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court will hear the case in October, and if the court agrees, then every district line in the country can be re-examined in every state in the nation.
All right, so that is the efficiency gap. That is the test that the court is determining if this is a valid test or not. Really, Anthony Kennedy is determining it. Sadly, the strict constitutionalists are not on our side on this. They are on the side of not having the courts get involved in elections at all, and that will likely vote against this test being brought into existence. The liberals on the court all argued that it's an essential right to vote, that you have a right to vote, and there's basically everything that the left is screaming is that there's voter disenfranchisement, which is all bull. There's, you know, I am for voter ID. We have had voter ID for 10 years or more here in Indiana. There's never been anybody that hasn't been able to vote. So it's just, it makes common sense that if you go to any place in America, you have to show ID to buy a product. Why wouldn't you show your photo ID when you vote? And county clerks do go to extraordinary lengths to make sure that people vote, in my experience. So it's not, but you do have voter disenfranchisement with gerrymandering. You have the, a lot of people don't run for the Libertarian Party because they don't think they can win, or they don't vote for Libertarians because they don't think their vote will count, right? Well, that happens with Republicans and Democrats. Here in Indiana, there's a tremendous amount of Republican candidates that will not have any opponent in the upcoming election. In any given election cycle, it's 60% of the state House and state Senate candidates go totally unopposed in the state because nobody wants to run to lose, and people of the opposite parties don't show up to vote because they don't think they can win. And so gerrymandering has a chilling effect on candidates and voters. And there needs to be some sort of test for us to be able to determine if the line's drawn or proper or not. Some people have said the test should be 5% of that particular efficiency gap or 8%. But once you get up to 13%, they say that's inappropriate. So keep an eye out on that. We'll do a longer episode on that in the future because it's one of the most important rulings, I think, in our republic. And if they go the wrong way on it, Kennedy may, who knows how Kennedy comes down on it, but he signaled that he would like a test. He may write his own test. Nobody knows. So hopefully they do the right thing here. Boys, it's been a pleasure. It's been fun.
For you, maybe. I'm pissed off over here.
Why? Why are you mad?
Gerrymandering shit.
Are you mad?
I'm mad.
You mad, bro?
I'm restless.
I know.
I'm ready for this military tribunal and and parade.
You should definitely go to the YouTube channel. Please subscribe. We've added about 100 subscribers this month.
Let's just rename the live video, or I guess any video, the Mittens Show.
Mittens TV. Literally for the last 10 minutes during Creighton's last rant, Mittens plopped herself right up in front of Creighton's head.
Just staring at the same spot, not even looking, just one spot.
Just chilling out.
Just staring at the camera, stealing your souls. So go to the YouTube channel. Please hit subscribe. If we hit 1,000, I can remonetize the videos. So please do that. So please like our YouTube channel, subscribe to it. Watch if you are. I watch a lot of podcasts at work. Like I consume Rogan on YouTube at work. And so I post video of every single episode up there, so every single podcast that we have and have ever done, you can find on our YouTube channel and go back and listen that way. We're on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, Overcast, Downcast, Castro, literally any way that you can listen to a podcast.
Pornhub.
We are on... We Are Libertarians Radio is on TuneIn, Apple Radio. If you go into iTunes and look through the radio station, the news and politics, we're there. I am about to deploy an Android and an Apple app, so you can listen to Ooh. We Are Libertarians Radio on an actual mobile app.
Who developed that?
It is through this company called Radio.co that I use to stream the radio station, and I ran out of storage, so I had to bump it up to $100 a month, and you get a free Android and Apple app. So I just have to come up with the extra $125 to buy the licenses from Apple and Android to buy whatever, you know. So, but I'll probably do that here in the next few days, and so within the next so within the next month, I have been officially accepted to Radio Row at Students for Liberty's Liberty Con.
Yay!
At the beginning of next month, so I will be there. My mom and I are going. So,
nice. Wow,
yeah, she's never been to Washington D.C.
Oh, that she's not even going to go to the thing.
She's not going to Liberty Con. She made that very clear. Was telling her about this. She's like, "Can I go?" I immediately said no. Because my mom and I have never been that close, but we're getting closer as we kind of get older and as the family gets back together. She said, "Aw," and she's like, "I've always wanted to see the Smithsonian. I've sent you kids so many times." I was like, "All right, you're gonna pay for the hotel."
How long is it? It's just Friday to Sunday.
Yeah. So
that's plenty of time.
So she's gonna go to the Smithsonian out.
When is the date for it?
It's March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd.
It'll be kind of warm.
Yep. So that'll be fun. I'm also going to go to the Libertarian National Convention. So if you're going to LibertyCon or the LP convention, let's all get together. We'll pick a spot. Let me know if you're going. Shoot me an email at editor@wearelibertarians.com or a Facebook message and say, "Hey, I'm going too." Tweet at us. Whatever. Let me know you're going to be there, and then we'll set something up and maybe find a spot for the We Are Libertarians listeners to all get together and meet each other. That'll be a lot of fun. Thank you to Brandon Luke, Craig DaCosta, Jason Doolittle, and Christy Avery for being our $100 a month subscribers. You guys are awesome. And everybody that has joined us on Patreon, you guys do so much for us. Like I said, those Android and Apple apps, that's because of you guys. That's the only reason I'm able to do it. You guys are the only reason I'm going to be able to travel to two events this year. You're the only reason I'm going to be able to buy materials for that event, so I appreciate all that very much. It takes a decent chunk of money to run this thing, as we've grown over the years, and we are growing 1,000 a month. We are averaging 7,000 per episode, which is huge.
Huge.
When we started the 2 a week, it was 4,000 a week. Now we're up to 7,000 a week in just 6 months or so.
And subscribers?
Yeah, downloads per episode. Wow. So tremendous, tremendous download base. So you guys are great.
Yeah. And look at me not preparing for anything.
No, you never prepare for a thing.
Still works.
If you read consistently, then you're prepared for this.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
if you just click the links and then read them, you'll be all right.
All right. So thank you so much for joining us here on this episode of We Are Libertarians. And until next week, we say
promise to do better next time.
Let's just say something like that.
No, it's keep them holstered unless you're ready for a shootout.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Wubba-lubba-dub-dub.
Bye.